It's Tuesday, December 17, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The cover story in Time magazine for the end of the year says it all. It's Pope Francis, Person of the Year. We saw this coming. As a matter of fact, it seemed almost inevitable by the time we got to the last half of 2013, given the incredible publicity machine and cultural momentum built by this pope, the first Jesuit pope, Francis I. On the one hand, it's not all that remarkable for a pope to be chosen as Time magazine's Person of the Year, formerly Man of the Year. After all, several of his predecessors in the 20th century were likewise chosen. But what makes it so unique at this moment is that it is this moment, a highly secular moment, a moment when the Catholic Church specifically, and so much of what is considered institutionalized religion, has been on a retreat, not only in Europe, but also in much of the United States. Time magazine is one of the representations of the mainstream culture in this country, and it is highly sensitive to intellectual and cultural directions. It intends not only to reflect a signal, but to send a signal, and that's very clear in choosing Francis I, the Pope, as the Person of the Year for 2013. In the article, a very large article explaining the choice, the authors explain this. But what makes this pope so important is the speed with which he has captured the imaginations of millions who have given up hoping for the church at all. End quote. The predictability in this particular choice comes down to the fact that Francis I has used the enormous influence and the publicity machine of the Vatican in order to change the public relations equation for the Roman Catholic Church. Catholicism has been reeling in much of the developed world, especially in Europe and in the United States, over huge scandals related to child sexual abuse, and furthermore, divisive issues that have made very clear that the lay Catholic population is at direct odds from the leadership of the Church on crucial theological, ethical, and moral teachings. Teachings that would include birth control, abortion, and most pointedly of late, sexuality and homosexuality in particular. What we're looking at in this situation is something that was predictable from the media side, but it is also going to prompt a very interesting conversation. It also, from a Christian worldview perspective, points to a host of issues for our active consideration. One of them is this. What does it mean to exchange one set of public relations for another? It could mean something significant, or it could mean something less. Now, immediately, people are onto that in asking the question about Francis I. For instance, in the space of just a few inches, print inches, in this edition of Time magazine, we read, quote, "Through these conscious and skillful evocations of movements in the ministry of Jesus, as recounted in the Gospels, this new pope may have found a way out of the 20th century culture wars, which have left the church moribund in much of Western Europe and on the defensive from Dublin to Los Angeles. But the paradox of the papacy is that each new man's success is burdened by the astonishing successes of popes past. The weight of history, of doctrines and dogmas woven intricately century by century, genius by genius, is both the source and the limitation of papal power." The article continues, "It radiates from every statue, crypt, and hand-painted vellum text in Rome and in churches, libraries, hospitals, universities, and museums around the globe. A pope sets his own course only if he can conform it to the paths already chosen." So says Time magazine. Then the magazine declares this, "And so Francis signals great change while giving the same answers to the uncomfortable questions. On the question of female priests, we need to work harder to develop a profound theology of the woman," the Pope said, which means no. No to abortion, because an individual life begins at conception. No to gay marriage, because the male-female bond is established by God. Quote, "The teaching of the church is clear, and I am a son of the church," the Pope has said, but, and here he adds his prayer for himself, "it's not necessary to talk about these issues all the time," end quote. Thus, Time magazine sets out in two successive paragraphs the great paradox of Pope Francis I. The paradox that lands him as the Person of the Year of Time magazine, in other words, a pope that has attracted enormous secular adulation and popular attention, but the pope that at the same time is duly authorized only to teach that which the church has taught on these issues. And so Time magazine has it exactly right. When it comes to the most contentious issues, the very issues that have separated so many lay Catholics from the leadership of their church, the pope is in the position of saying, no change, but a new attitude, a smile, and perhaps a new energy, a new symbolism, and a new set of gestures. But at the same time, it's a new pope, but it's the same papacy, and it's the same Roman Catholic Church with the same teachings. The bishops of the church are duty-bound, bound by office and by confession, to apply the very doctrines the pope has suggested ought not always to be talked about. Bishops often don't have a choice about having to address these issues, especially when they arise in their area of responsibility and in their churches. The Pope, who operates like a monarch, can decide when and where he will address these issues. But his priests and his bishops cannot so decide. That puts the Pope at a distinct advantage from others in his own church. He can decide if and when he'll speak to these things. He can speak to them in the way he chooses, either long or short, succinct or elaborated, and he can offer what kind of attitude he chooses. But the people who are actually leading and applying Catholicism on the ground, they can't choose so carefully as the Pope might do. Two articles in successive days in the New York Times make this point poignantly. The first is by Frank Bruni, a gay columnist for the New York Times, who in the opinion section of Sunday's newspaper spoke of the Catholics he described as still in exile. He writes this: honeymoon isn't a word usually associated with pontiffs, but Pope Francis is having an extraordinary one. Last week, Time magazine named him its person of the year, saying that he had given fresh hope to many Catholics estranged by the Church's censorious ways. The magazine also noted the absence of harsh condemnation in his mentions of divorced couples, of women seeking abortions, and of gay people, including his statement that, quote, if a homosexual person is of goodwill and is in search of God, I am no one to judge, end quote. From all this, writes Frank Bruni, Time concluded that he had lifted the Church, quote, above the doctrinal police work so important to his recent predecessors, end quote. Then Bruni writes this very poignant line, quote, well, they didn't get the memo in the suburbs of Philadelphia, end quote. Frank Bruni is talking about there a professor of French and Spanish fired from a Catholic high school when he let the school know he was going to be engaging in a same-sex marriage. He says the memo also didn't make it to Little Rock, Arkansas, where another teacher, in this case an English teacher, at a high school affiliated with the Sisters of Mercy, was also let loose because she was identified as being in a lesbian relationship. Then Bruni writes this very important paragraph. He writes, Pope Francis has indeed been a revelation. His gentle tone and sustained humility more in touch with the heart of Catholicism than the bitter Jeremiads of other Catholic leaders were. But it's important to note that he hasn't pledged to revisit doctrine, nor are such revisions likely to happen anytime soon. The world turns at a breathless clip, the Church at a glacial one, end quote. Bruni then cites Nick Johns, whose Catholic church outside Atlanta asked him to resign from his job as an organist last May. After it became known, says Bruni, that he had a male fiancé, quote, they made it clear that they didn't think being gay is wrong, but they think gay people should be celibate. And now that I've found the love of my life, I can't imagine God wanting me to suppress that. If God made us and he gave us the gift of love and he gave me that gift and he made me this way, why wouldn't he want this? End quote. Well, speaking as an outsider to Catholicism, I can suggest that this former organist has a legitimate question to ask. It does appear that this pope is rather strategically and intentionally sending what can only be considered mixed signals. In this case, this gay man is hearing the signals as decidedly mixed, but so also are conservatives in the Catholic Church who are hearing these same mixed signals coming from their own pontiff. Writing the very next day, that is yesterday, in the New York Times, Kenan Malik writes of the British Catholics' quandary. He says this, quote, they call it the Francis effect, the impact of Pope Francis in galvanizing the Catholic faithful. Since he arrived at the Vatican, he writes, church attendance has surged across the world, while in his homeland of Argentina, the number of people defining themselves as believers has risen by a reported 12%. He then writes, yet how much has really changed? Francis may be transforming the perception of the church and its mission, but not its core doctrines. He has called for a church more welcoming to gay people and women, but he will not challenge the idea that homosexual acts are sinful, refuses to embrace the possibility of same-sex marriage, and insists that the ordination of women as priests is, quote, not open to discussion, end quote. And then you have to add to the mix the fact that The Advocate, one of the world's most influential homosexual magazines, also chose its person of the year for 2013, and they made the same choice, Pope Francis I. In their article, they wrote this, the most influential person of 2013 doesn't come from our ongoing legal conflict, but instead from our spiritual one, successes from which are harder to define. There has not been any vote cast or ruling issued, and still a significant and unprecedented shift took place this year in how LGBT, that's lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender persons, are considered by one of the world's largest faith communities. Pope Francis is leader of 1.2 billion Roman Catholics all over the world. There are three times as many Catholics in the world as there are citizens in the United States. Like it or not, what he says makes a difference. Sure, we all know Catholics who fudge on the religion's rules about morality. There's a lot of disagreement, they write, about the role of women, about contraception and more. But none of that should lead us to underestimate any pope's capacity for persuading hearts and minds in opening to LGBT people, not only in the U.S., but globally. Then, in a very revealing sentence, the editors of The Advocate say this: the remaining holdouts for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender acceptance in religion, the ones who block progress in the work left to do, will more likely be persuaded by a figure they know, in the same way that President Obama transformed politics with his evolution on LGBT civil rights. A change from the Pope would have a lasting effect on religion. Again, very interesting. What does the Advocate see in Pope Francis? Well, they see the kind of mixed message that others have seen as well. They're choosing, very strategically, and in the context of their article, actually quite honestly, to seize upon what they see as the more hopeful side of that mixed message from their perspective, and to try to disregard that which they do not like. They write about what they describe as his stark change in rhetoric. They write about the symbolism of his office, and yet they also write about the fact, in their honesty, that the Catholic Church is still not on the side of the homosexual revolution. But then they write this: as Pope, he has not yet said the Catholic Church supports civil unions, but what Francis does say about LGBT people has already caused reflection and consternation within his church. The moment that grabbed headlines was during a flight from Brazil to Rome. When asked about gay priests, Pope Francis told reporters, according to a translation from Italian, quote, "If someone is gay and seeks the Lord of goodwill, who am I to judge?" End quote. They then write, "The brevity of that statement and the outsized attention it immediately got are evidence of the Pope's sway. His posing a simple question with very Christian roots, when uttered in this context by this man, who am I to judge, became a signal to Catholics and the world that the new Pope is not like the old Pope." End quote. Well, let's wait just a minute. Well, this Pope is unlike the one who came before him, indeed, especially unlike the two who came before him, on these issues in terms of style. But in terms of substance, he represents the very same teaching. That makes you wonder exactly how a magazine like The Advocate is choosing to make such an example here. But even as the how might be hard to understand, the why is very easy to understand. They're leaping upon the Pope's statements in hope that they will force a change in their direction in the teachings and doctrine of the Church. And they're also hoping that the Pope's example in this case will be used to give a signal to the Catholics in the pew, the Catholics on the ground, suggesting that 1.2 billion Catholics should be transformed in their understanding of human sexuality and of homosexuality in particular, without regard to the ongoing doctrine of the Church. By the way, one footnote here: when we look at what the Pope actually said in that interview, asking the question, if someone is gay and seeks the Lord of goodwill, who am I to judge, that has to be understood in the context of Catholic moral teaching that says that if one does seek the Lord of goodwill, one will be obedient to the law of the Church. In other words, this would be a celibate homosexual person. In other words, not the people who are celebrating the fact that the Pope made this statement. But the papacy is not an amateur operation. It is a massive would-be monarchy. And as such, it has a massive public relations machinery at its control, and nothing is done by accident. This was an intentional act, and it was broadcast around the world, amplified by the Vatican's own public relations operation. In other words, the Pope intentionally sent this signal. And even as he knew, the Vatican was well aware it was being misunderstood in terms of Catholic doctrine, and nonetheless was allowing it to go forward, because it's about public relations, at least evidently so. To an evangelical Christian, this is all somewhat perplexing. It is interesting to note the particular quandary that conservative Roman Catholics find themselves in this situation. Here you have a Pope who is giving them indigestion, a Pope who is sending mixed signals on the issues on which they've spilled a great deal of blood and a great deal of their personal reputation. They have committed themselves to the doctrines of their Church. They have defended them in public. They have defended them in private. Now they find themselves in a position where their own moral authority is being undercut by the papacy, by the Pope of their Church, who has suggested that you don't have to talk about these things all the time, disregarding the fact that most American church leaders and most American Catholic intellectuals don't talk about this because they choose to talk about this, but because it's the issue of the most fervent and intense cultural conversation. Silence would be cowardice. But the quandary comes down to this: the people who are most likely to be offended by the Pope's message in this case are the people who, as conservative Roman Catholics, are the most committed to the authority of their Church and to its structures. There's their quandary. Liberal Catholics are always picking and choosing what authorities they will accept and what messages they're going to endorse. Conservative Catholics are committed to the totality of the teaching of their Church and to the teaching office of the Church, which finds its pinnacle and pontiff in the Pope, unless they find themselves in a very difficult position. Looking at this from a different direction, evangelicals often get some kind of magisterium envy when we look at Roman Catholics. After all, there is an official mechanism for establishing the doctrine of the Church. There is an official magisterium that is charged by the authority of its own hierarchy to establish the official teaching of the Church, to defend Catholic orthodoxy, and to speak with authority on what the Roman Catholic Church teaches and believes. Evangelicals lack any kind of magisterium. We certainly lack a pontiff. We have no pope. And thus, there is no one who speaks with this authority. There is no one who can stipulate individually or hierarchically exactly what evangelicals are to believe and what are the boundaries of evangelical faith and how these things are to be understood and applied. But every time evangelicals get magisterium envy, they need to look very closely at the quandary that conservative Roman Catholics find themselves in this very moment. In other words, without throwing stones, let me suggest that not only is the papacy an unbiblical office for reasons that should become clear, but in practical terms, it turns out that the only thing worse than not having a pope is having one. It might seem operationally preferable at times to have a singular voice and a singular authority. And that works if that singular authority is always right, always benevolent, always true. But it isn't true to the New Testament, and it isn't true to the model of apostolic doctrine and apostolic structure we find in the early church. In the early church, Paul faced down Peter. In the early church, there were issues that were decided amongst the apostles. There was no pope. There was no papacy. There was no magisterium. There was a spiritual authority, but that authority was on the basis of God's calling, and it was on the basis of the authority of the Word as assigned to those who would be the preachers of the Church of God. And that's why, in the evangelical world, there is a dispersion of such authorities, and that authority isn't hierarchical, it's the authority of calling that is based upon the authority of God's Word. But even from a practical consideration, we can see the problems that are inherent in the Pope being chosen as Time's Person of the Year. This may make Roman Catholics proud, and it may make Roman Catholics of different stripes very concerned about what this means about the direction of their church. But the fact is that the focus on a person of the year is appropriate for Time magazine. But what kind of person is a singular focus of a church? What we're looking at here is a very dangerous situation, both on practical as well as principial and biblical terms. When there's this much focus on a single individual, when this much authority, even a monarchical authority, is implied in the office, when claims are made about revelation beyond Scripture, we clearly have a situation that is deadly dangerous for the church. That danger was one central issue that brought the reformers into direct collision with the Roman Catholic Church in the 16th century, and it's a continuing issue that evangelicals had better remember at all times. When it came to the last two popes on issues of the sanctity of human life and human sexuality, the theology of the body, and the absolute nature of truth, evangelicals found much with which to agree. But in such situations, we need to agree that we agree with those popes because they're right, not because they're the Pope. In terms of this development and the issue of the papacy, there is much more that must be said, but not now. And there are other things going on in the world today that deserve our attention, but there's not time to discuss them today. So, we'll discuss them the rest of the week. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.